Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. Yesterday, Israel launched wide-scale strikes against Iran, saying it targeted nuclear facilities, ballistic missile factories and military commanders. Claire opened her conversation with Shashank Joshi, defence editor of The Economist, by asking him why Benjamin Netanyahu had decided to launch this attack now.
I think that at the macro level, it was looking at an Iranian nuclear programme that was growing in size and scope with ever more enriched uranium capable of being enriched further into bombs. But at the more narrow level, I think it also saw that US-Iran nuclear talks were faltering, that there was maybe less prospect of a deal coming out of this that would contain Iran's nuclear program. And of course, looking at the last year or so, it looked ahead and saw an Iran that was severely weakened, with both Iran and its allies like Hezbollah in Lebanon severely weakened by last year's skirmishing, and thought that if it took this action, the retaliation it would face now would be far, far less than that which it might have expected if we were having this conversation 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. And so that combination of factors, I think, drove it to conduct this attack. I'm skeptical about its public claim that it saw imminent intelligence about an accelerating nuclear program. I'm skeptical of that.
You're skeptical of this claim by Benjamin Netanyahu that Iran has enough fuel to quickly convert into 9 nuclear weapons.
I'm not skeptical of that.
Right.
That's true. Iran has, you know, upwards of 400 kilograms of uranium enriched to more than 60%. 60% is a very, very short distance in enrichment terms from weapons grade, which is 90%. And that is enough for quite a few bombs if enriched further, and that could happen fairly fast. So he's not wrong there. However, you still have to turn that into a weapon. You still have to then mate that to a delivery system like a missile. And Iran's nuclear program, it was broadly halted in 2003. There were some elements that continued, but there was no decision to build a bomb. From Israel's perspective, what they'd say is there may not have been a decision to build a bomb, but they were putting all the bits in place that would have allowed them to do so significantly quicker. And so Israel was effectively like a boiling frog.
Iran has described Israel's actions as a declaration of war. So, how is Iran likely to react? On Morning Ireland, Gavin got the view of Middle East expert Fawaz Gurghaz, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science.
Iran faces an existential struggle. This is an attack against the state. This is an attack against the beating heart of Iran's elite. They have killed top commanders, including the second most important man after the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. They killed 6 nuclear scientists. If Iran does not respond decisively, this really would mean the end of the Islamic clerical regime in Iran. And the regime has been threatening to respond and respond decisively for the past few weeks. So we shall see whether this was bluster on the part of Iran or Iran has the capacity to retaliate and retaliate decisively. The next few days will be decisive.
And on the News at One, Paul Cunningham brought us this clip of Director General of the International Atomic Energy Association, Rafael Grossi, warning against any escalation of hostilities.
I reiterate that any military action that jeopardizes the safety and security of nuclear facilities risks grave consequences for the people of Iran, the region, and beyond. I stand ready to engage with all relevant parties to help ensure the protection of nuclear facilities and the continued peaceful use of nuclear technology in accordance with the agency mandate, including deploying agency nuclear security and safety experts in addition to our safeguards inspectors in Iran, wherever necessary, to ensure that nuclear installations are fully protected and continue to be used exclusively for peaceful purposes.
Also on the line, Middle East analyst Borzu Daragahi.
The US President Donald Trump said Iran must strike a deal on its nuclear program before, he said, there's nothing left. Do you think the strategy of sign up or get bombed will work?
I do not. I think that Iran would go with option C, which is don't sign up, get bombed and bomb back before they would negotiate under such circumstances. I don't think there's any record of Iran succumbing to that kind of pressure at this point. I have a feeling that things are going to get a little bit uglier before they get any better.
Oy, 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 from the news at one yesterday. Here at home, news was dominated by major changes proposed for the rental sector. On Tuesday, it was announced rent pressure zones would be extended across the country. Now, that was initially planned for March 1st next year, but it was later clarified that legislation was being prepared to allow that change to happen as soon as possible. More on that later. But from March 1st next year, for new tenancies, rents will be set at the market rate with a 6-year lease. For large landlords, those with 4 or more tenancies, a ban on no-fault evictions within those 6 years. For small landlords, more limited circumstances in which they can end tenancies as a no-fault eviction. And they were just the headlines. It was a lot and a bit bamboozling. Here's Claire, herself no slouch in the detail department, with housing lecturer Lorcan Sir.
It's now incredibly complex. I won't tell you the number of hours and back and forth that
I've
spent
trying
to get...
I agree with you, because I'm sitting there reading and going, OK, you've got people who are pre-2022, post... Then you've got a 6-year lease. There's all sorts... And you've got new bills.
Yeah, it's incredibly convoluted.
It's complicated.
You don't say. And a lot of the detail to be hammered out in legislation. But all of this to encourage the building of more apartments and increase, yes, you've guessed it, supply. And these changes would, according to government, offer more security for renters and certainty to investors. On Morning Ireland, Gavin spoke to Ronan Lyons, Professor of Economics at Trinity, author of the Daft.ie rent reports and former member of the state-appointed Housing Commission.
If I wanted to build a set of new apartments and put them up for rent today, or I put them up for rent in March, why would I be more encouraged to do it in March than I would be now?
It's not really that there'll be a whole load of stuff being held off or not. I think the interest is more in, will there be new projects proposed now that the rules have changed?
But why would there be likely to be?
So the key bit here is, if you, under the current system since 2021, if you built a new rental home, the most you could ever increase your rent year on year was 2%, and that applied across tenancies. That was in perpetuity. And what that does is, if inflation were to go above 2%, or indeed if your cost of maintenance were to rise faster than inflation, it means that running an apartment block is a losing proposition. So we saw very little investment in new rental housing in Ireland after those rules were changed in 2021. Even as investment increased in some jurisdictions, it didn't increase everywhere, but the fall in Ireland was quite harsh. It was about by almost three quarters, and some places saw a fall by a third, some places saw investment rise. So yes, the international environment changed, but Ireland's rules changed as well, and we could see that impact in the investment.
But inflation is much more than 2% at the moment anyway.
That's correct. It's not about the 2% per se. It's about the ability when the tenant leaves to reset to the market. It's known as vacancy decontrol in the rent control world. And it's quite a common feature in other systems. The new system will mean that when the tenant voluntarily leaves, the landlord will have the opportunity to reset the rent to the market level. And so you're no longer linked to that very first rent you set on that very first day. And that may seem like a relatively small change, but what it does is it moves Ireland from one type of rent control system to another, and in particular to a type of rent control system that has less harmful effects on supply. Because you can reset the rent between tenants, that means there's more of an incentive to maintain properties and to keep the quality of, and indeed keep the quantity of rental housing up as well.
Ronan Lyons on Morning Ireland. And with Sarah on Drive Time, this view from Kate English, Chief Economist with Deloitte.
Is it enough to incentivize new supply? The important thing here is it does one of two things. One, it gives the option that if inflation was to increase again, that landlords have an option of increasing a rent above that 2%, because there's a lot of costs involved in running a large apartment block that is rented out. And that's what wasn't there for the past few years. But the second part here, and I think this is critical, is that it signals to the market that private capital is welcome. And we have had an awful lot of change in rental policies for the past few years that for the most part signaled the opposite. And it's all back to, I keep thinking when we're having this discussion the last few days of, you know, we need over 20 billion to deliver 50,000 homes.
I know,
homes
and we only
year.
Have about 7 billion ourselves. Yeah, so we need most of it from private.
Capital.
But I do wonder, is it to what end are we inviting or trying to attract in this private capital to deliver this type of supply, which is going to be expensive apartments, probably built to rent at the very top end of the market. And again, with no real protection from renters because they can increase rent now in line with inflation. So 2023, 6% inflation, you could see yourself with a 6% rent increase. Your salary doesn't do anything like that that year. To what end? Is this the right way to go? Is that sort of supply going to fix all our problems?
I think this is the important thing is that this is just one step. There are other measures that will be needed to stimulate that supply as well. You're right, these new apartments that will be delivered, if this policy works in line with other ones that are introduced as well, will only feed a certain part of the market. And it's back to then why we need to be delivering more and more of all tenure types.
However, with Clare, a different view. Back to Lorcan Sir, Senior Lecturer in Housing at Technological University Dublin.
The starting point is problematic, isn't it? Because you've got, you're trying to do two conflicting things if you're the government. You're trying to attract investment, but you're trying to protect renters as well and keep rents down. You can't really do both if the investment is coming from the private sector who, as you say, want to make money from rent.
Yeah, exactly. So ultimately, the government is trying, as my colleague says, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places. It's trying to control a market, and a market has a different agenda and, you know, different strategic aims than you know, a government or society, which is about making returns. So the government's plan or the government's thinking is that in order to attract private fund investment into the rental sector, rents need to rise. So in order to attract supply, we need to have rising rents, and rising rents, this is our way of combating the problem we have of rising rents.
So if a tenant does move between rental properties, what might these new changes bring?
You might have somebody who's in a property for several years and has been covered by rent pressure zones and is paying, say, we just throw figures out there, 1,500 a month.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, rents are accelerated. So next year they could get hit with, or the next time their tenancy agreement is up, or if they have to move properties like students or people moving for work, they could end up paying, say, $2,500 or two, in the case of Dublin, 2,180 odd euro.
And there's nothing to stop the landlord charging that amount they're permitted to under these new rules.
And the other issue with the concept of market rents, and it hasn't been raised so far, is like, what does it actually mean? So a market rent is what somebody's willing to pay for the property, which is fine. If you bring in, say, new properties into an area, and there are places like Island Bridge in Dublin, for example, which is full of built-to-rents and things like that. If you bring in luxurious new, you know, 8-storey, beautiful gym and creche and all that kind of stuff, and the rent for a 2-bed is 3,000 into an area where typically the rent for a 2-bed has been 1,800, 3,000 is now the market rent. So what will happen there is that landlords are going to turn and say, well, look, at the guys down the road are getting $3,000 for their 2 beds. I should be getting as close to that as possible. So what will happen is it will drag the average rent in an area up all the way.
Housing lecturer Lorcan Sir with Clare. But back to the extension of those rent pressure zones and the changing timelines. On Drive Time, Sarah put this to Fianna Fáil Minister of State Robert Troy.
Really a lot of confusion as to what is going on here, because we had Ona Brin on the programme earlier saying that the briefing from housing officials on Tuesday afternoon that was that there was going the RPZ extension across the country wasn't going to be happening till March 2026. I had your colleague on Primetime on Tuesday night who seemed to have the same understanding, and yet we're being told in the Dáil today that legislation's being rushed through next week. Did the government just not realise that this would be problematic?
Well, I think what the government wants to do is to bring about certainty. We're aware that the rent pressure zone was going to extend at the end of this year, early next year. We want to give certainty, and at the same time, we want to ensure that the reforms that are being introduced provide certainty for existing tenants and incentivise investment
yeah,
into
but the,
new
the question
the construction
is, when was the
new...
decision made to rush through that legislation? Because nobody seemed to know about it on Tuesday.
Well, I think the decision was taken at Cabinet in relation to reform the rent pressure zones. And at that time, and I think I was in the Dáil myself during leaders' questions on Tuesday, and the Taoiseach said quite clearly that legislation was being worked on and would be brought in at the earliest possible date. So I don't think there was any uncertainty in relation that the legislation was being worked on and was going to be brought into the Dáil.
But as the week closed, more questions as to timelines and detail. On The Gathering with Clare, Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror.
You know, it just doesn't seem thought through. It's been an exhausting week because, I mean, even coming back from that press conference on Tuesday, the journalists were a few of us just gathered in the hallway outside the canteen in Leinster House, and we were going, what's going on? Like, what happens if in this situation? What happens in, you know, that situation? And we were just so confused. And we had been at the press conference with the minister, and we had the press release right in front of us, and it's just been so muddled. It really, really has. And it's so hard to communicate to people what it means for them. And at the end of the day, there are more than likely a lot of worried renters out there who are wondering, what does this mean for us? If I was a renter at the moment, I'd be tearing my hair out because I would be so confused. I'd be really, really confused.
And just a few short minutes later, Claire read this.
We have a statement just in from James Brown, who's been speaking in Galway, the Minister for Housing. He's defending his measures in relation to the rental market. He's acknowledging that there were a few different moving parts in the planned legislation, but he said these were necessary given the scale of the accommodation issues that the country is facing. There's always going to be a challenge around the complexity of doing anything like this. There's a no one size fits all to bring a solution to this kind of complex situation. And he spoke about the balance being struck between protecting tenants and making sure that investors are willing to embark on building projects. He said a massive step change was needed in this regard in terms of protecting existing tenants and increasing the supply. But he believes the measures announced this week would help to make it happen.
And there we will leave it for now. Back in a bit. Welcome back. With Dermot in for Oliver, comedian Gerlath Regan. He's just finished a US tour where the mammyisms travel very well.
Can they relate to the Irish mammy stuff, even if they're not Irish?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. I mean, I put a lot of stand-up up there as well, which is kind of universal stuff. And
yes,
you think the Irish mammy, everyone thinks it's so their own thing. My ma's so different from everyone else's. I get messages from, this is Jewish mothers, this is Italian mothers, this is Sri Lankan mothers. It's mind-blowing the connection that people have that way, that they all seem to go to the same mom university. I don't know.
I'm not so wrong. Didn't you go for a run yesterday?
I wouldn't mind, but she's the one that's complaining she has no energy all the time.
But didn't you do a marathon last year or some sort of fun run? Do you remember your man up the road who used to do the marathons? He used to run all the time. Do you know where he is now? I don't know where he is now. Do you know?
Don't even talk to me about the football and the hurling. These sports have gone so dangerous. It's so physical. It's rough now. And I blame the energy drink.
Swimming?
Your brother was a fabulous swimmer.
I blame the energy drinks.
Yeah. Too much energy now.
Those connections that are made with no scientific backing. Just that's it now.
And
we've
said
decided.
With such authority.
I love the reviews you get. Regan is an expert storyteller, and this is a beautifully constructed show that I could have happily listened to for twice its length, says the Arts Desk. And then the next review is a superb guest, Airbnb.
Both as meaningful, right?
And this grow for the razzle-dazzle, the spotlight, was born on the basketball court.
The attraction was that it wasn't Gaelic football. Mm-hmm. And Gaelic football is very much mullock into them, drop the shoulder, you know, none of the fancy dance stuff, lads. Whereas basketball was all show. It's why I'm in entertainment.
Yeah.
It's all performance, fancy clothes, trickery, moves, high-flying dunks. Mm. It was all about entertainment. And I realise now, looking back on it, that I was obsessed with the sport because it was, it was Hollywood. It was the big stage, the big lights, the backstage, the preparation for it, and then coming out and delivering when the lights were on.
And the two talked gigging, comedy, parenting and podcasts.
Like everybody out there, you're trying to be a dad, you're trying to do it all. And in some ways, that's where a lot of the comedy comes from, is that none of us are getting it right. Everyone, in terms of the parenting, that podcast is about trying to raise your kid not to be a gobshite. And the biggest fear every parent has is that the horse is already bolted. It's too late.
And in 2017, to top it all off, he gave his brother Adrian a kidney. And he's being very cool about the whole thing.
Do you talk to him about it still? You're like, how's the kidney?
I try not to lord it over him.
That's pretty impressive bragging rights, in fairness. You know, anytime there's a lull in the conversation at Christmas.
My family never bring it up. It never comes up in our family, ever.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come up at Christmas. We don't do a toast to it or anything on the day that it... It doesn't come up.
You don't still walk around clutching your side?
Occasionally, yeah. I'll go, this is what you got me for Christmas.
Did it make you and your brother closer?
It definitely changed the relationship forever. You would be weird if you weren't closer. I'm partially him. It's hard not to connect with each other in a different way now.
Yeah. Would you do it again?
Oh, in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
In a heartbeat. But I draw the line at one. Very rarely.
If he comes back for seconds, you're like,
here. And there you have it. Jarlath Regan with Dermot. But in the midst of all that, we did get this wee observation.
I remember you talking about Mikey, your son, and moving back from the UK and seeing how long it would take for his English accent to disappear. And I realised when I was thinking about it, it's kind of like sometimes in Ireland we treat the English accent like a bit of a silly haircut that you got that hopefully you can grow out of, you know.
It is funny that before we came back, everyone was asking, has he got one? Mm-hmm. And then when he came back, it was gone in the space of 2 weeks. And it's just people just settle in to that.
And that brings us rather nicely to Ed Sheeran, because he's been saying that he identifies culturally as Irish, his kith and kin and all that. But he was brought up in Suffolk.
So I think if you grow up with the choice of being from Suffolk or feeling that you're Irish, come on, mate.
Well, you know what? I don't know anything much about Suffolk, but I do know what you mean, I think.
Stephen Fry called it the heart of darkness.
Calling it for Suffolk, musician and psychologist Coach O'Riordan. But she did have some sympathy for our Ed.
Does this resonate with you?
It really does. I thought it was such a lovely thing for him to say. Although, I mean, my first reaction was, well, duh. Who doesn't know that Ed Sheeran is Irish? But I love the thing he says. He feels culturally Irish, which is such a big thing. I would say to Irish people, be kind to the hyphen Irish. We don't mean any harm.
What does that mean, though? That's so interesting, because I had a college friend who was born in London of Irish parents, and he said to me, if I can mimic his accent, he says, I'm a Cockney.
Don't do it.
he says, I'm a Cockney in Connemara, he said, but I'm a Paddy in London.
Oh, spot on. Yeah, I've heard this from... I didn't have the big Irish family. All my dad's people left Ireland. They were very down on Ireland. There was no romance there. So I did have a little twinge of envy for friends that did have the family in Ireland. And they always said, it's mad, when we're here in England, we're Paddies, you know, no one can pronounce our names. Yeah. Or there's racism, anti-Irish racism, anti-Irish jokes. And then when we go to Ireland, to our supposed own people, we're English. They think we're Brits, and it's a head wreck.
You're in limbo land, kind of. It is weird, isn't it? I have cousins the same way.
Ah, you just can't win. But with Ray, the influence of the English language on Irish place names. Here's Dr. Cruhuro Coolig, and we'll let Ray take it from here.
The Chief Place Names Officer at the Place Names Branch, Department of Rural and Community Development and the Gaeltacht.
So there. And his job, to provide the definitive form of Irish language place names. And then we all got a bit of an education, not least the Darcy.
Let's just talk about general ones then. We all know what kill is. It's church.
No.
No. There you go. So we're wrong.
Sorry
there.
About that.
It's not a church.
It could be.
Right.
It could be. You see, the reason why we're actually needed as such is it's nice to be needed, as we say, you know. But the reason is because you can't always tell what the original Irish name was. by the anglicised form.
Okay.
The anglicised form can basically send you off in the wrong direction.
Well, there's a lot of us revising everything we thought we knew. Keep going.
So why did I think, and most people think, that kill refers to a church?
Because it very often does.
Aha. And if it doesn't refer to a church, what does it refer to?
If you think of the right way to think about this is that if you take a place name like Kilpatrick, K-I-L-P-A-T-R-I-C-K,
yeah,
that's the anglicised form of, yes, a place name. If you think of that, that actually means nothing. It doesn't mean anything.
The Church of Patrick, no.
No. But if I say Kilfarrick, we have to take our mind away from thinking what does Kilpatrick mean. You have to say, what does the underlying Irish form of Kilpatrick,
right,
mean?
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And in the case of Kilpatrick, normally it is Kilfarrick, yes, which is the Church of,
okay,
Patrick.
So Kildare, Kildare, the church of the Oak.
The Church of Oak, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Will you give me an example of a place name where Kill doesn't mean church?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Kilmore, in a lot of cases, doesn't mean on Hill War, the big church. It can mean on Hail or on Hill War, the big wood.
Aha,
okay,
right.
Well, that is a learning for many of us, I suspect. And it did not stop there.
These are all the things that I think I know to be true, but you're going to obviously say they're not. That Blackrock is the most popular place name in Ireland.
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. No. No.
Milltown.
No. Milltown, you're getting
close.
You're doing well on Milltown, I'd say now. Now, Milltown obviously is an English name. By the way, we don't have any responsibility for English names.
Yeah, okay.
At all.
Right. Okay.
At all.
Right.
I think the most common townland name is, according to Pat McKay, who did the Dictionary of Ulster Place Names many years ago. I'm depending on Pat on this now. Is Glebe.
Glebe?
It's an English name.
Right.
It's an English name. When the mass dispossessions occurred in the middle 1600s, as such 1650s, 1660s, most parishes, civil parishes, you know, were divided and given to whoever the new landowners were going to be, quite often Cromelian settlers. Generally, a part of that parish was put aside for the sustenance of the new Protestant clergyman who was going to be in that parish, and that was designated the glebe.
Ah, right.
So, really, I'm not saying all civil parishes throughout the country. Civil parishes correlate to the old medieval parishes.
Yes, yes. So there was nearly a glebe in every parish. What you're
saying. Exactly.
Oh, no messing there. And that brings us to our next clip. We are all about the links this week, because if you find yourself in Reykjavik, well, you might fit in rather nicely. Or so says Monco McGann. His new book is called Ireland in Iceland. For 'tis there our DNA lies.
If there is 60% of the DNA, then surely there must be, you know, symbols of that, signs of that in their appearance. And there are. Like, you can see the sort of the freckles and the blue eyes and the pasty face and the sort of mousy hair and the slight crunched back that we see in the west of Ireland, just facing off the wind and the steep slopes of the mountains, that you don't really associate with Scandinavia or with the Norse cultures. And then you start looking at the place names and you're saying, these place names that are, some of them, were there from the very beginning, from those first settlers, the Irish and the Norse, who came, whatever, from 875 AD onwards, so for, you know, 1,100 years. And you'll have place names like in the west, in the far northwest of Iceland, there's places called Írafell and Írafellsbunga. And Ír is just Irish, so Fell is mountain. So Irish mountain, Irish fells, Bunga would be the Irish, again, Bunga is in elevation, so another high point that the Irish were. Down in the south, you'll find these places called Papai and Papai. And Papa just means Pope, Papa, you know, the Pope. Mm-hmm. So because they thought, if their leaders, you know, if the Vikings group had some tribal elder, they'd meet these Christians who said, oh, my leader is the Pope. And so they would call them, these are the people who are followers of the Pope. But then again on the west, you'll have a place called like Patricksfjordr, where a bishop who was, you know, following the lineage of St. Patrick turned up. He was probably from the Hebrides. But again, Ireland, the Hebrides, it's the same culture. You have Kieronsvik, named after St. Kieron. The other place to look is in people's names. And a lot of Iceland, they don't really know about this, you know, because...
Well, we don't know about it either, but we're learning.
I know. And it's interesting, like, do we have a responsibility? If we settled a land that was entirely bare, nobody was ever there except a few Irish saints, you know, until, as I said, 875 AD. And if we settled it with our myths, our stories, our place names, our like goddess-centered view, you know, this sort of the Queen Maeve, the Queen Áine, that was the mindset we brought. And that's all gone now, because now you have this strong male Nordic idea of Odin and, you know, Thor and all. Do we have a responsibility maybe to go up to them and say, actually, you know, actually, Bjork, you have our goddesses. Bridget is your goddess too.
And continuing in that vein, sounds like Monkon has a plan to get the Icelandic-Irish band back together.
The keyboardist of Sigur Rós is Kjartan Sveinsson.
Right.
Now, I don't think he knows this, but Kjartan, it's an Irish name, Kjartan. It's from Murchartig. It's the Murchartig is the mariner, the sea chart, you know, Murchart, the sea chart. So his descendants were obviously sailors, navigators. He doesn't know that. You also find
We'll tell him.
Exactly.
We'll make sure
Knows. There's a famous film director and actor that the Icelandic people are very proud of called Baltasar Kormákur. And Kormákur is Cormac. Cormac Mach, the son of Cor. Cor is either from Caribod, the chariot, or Cor, the crane or the heron, who was a shamanic pagan figure, or Caribish ship. There's Neil in Neil's saga. Neil is obviously an Irish name. It means champion. Muel Kirkig, which would be Muel, the follower, the devotee of Kirkig. But probably there's even the patron saint of Iceland. There was a lot of Irish monks who brought Christianity to Iceland, but the patron saint is Thorlachar Thorhalsson, and Thorlach is from that name, Thorlach. You know.
Thorlach, yeah, of course.
And when Ireland and Iceland, closer than you'd think, comrades. Back in a bit. Welcome back. This week, the death of Brian Wilson and the passing of a legend.
Love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me, so what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
And from the golden pop hits of Good Vibrations to the groundbreaking album Pet Sounds, well, his work was very special. John Marr joined Sean on Arena to pay tribute.
And when we talk about Pet Sounds and what we're hearing there, how do you describe the style of what Brian Wilson did with a pop song, John?
I suppose symphonic, but with very much a West Coast sensibility, because in the early 60s, the Beach Boys were redefining what a pop song could be, and they were rooting it in their sort of Californian lifestyle. I mean, when you listen to Beach Boys from the 1960s, it's so evocative of blue skies and beaches and
head no surfing, yeah.
Beautiful girls and suntans and open top cars, and the music kind of captures that. It's upbeat, even when the lyrics can be quite downbeat. There is a sense of kind of that you're of a forward momentum, and just the sheer catchiness of the music.
And the Beach Boys could sing the most complex of arrangements, but oh so sweetly.
The harmonies, I mean, the vocal harmonies that he puts in there, and the rhythmic complexity that he puts into the songs.
Absolutely. I mean, the multi-part harmony is just something that is evocative and emblematic of the Beach Boys. And one could say that in music history, no band has managed to achieve the mellifluousness of what they did when they just had those harmonies at play. And that's one thing we have to remember about this particular group. They all could sing so beautifully. And like so many perfectionists, of which, of course, Brian Wilson was one, they were ruthlessly efficient in the studio. They worked ferociously hard. They only wanted the very best material to ever emerge from that. So they really put in the hard yards in order to do it. But we can still hear it. You know, we're 60 years on, these songs still sound so incredibly fresh. Yes, they are of a particular place and time, but they still sound incredible.
And John Marr talked about meeting the musician and the man.
This is about 20 years ago when he released Smile, which was, of course,
the kind of renaissance after his second marriage.
I mean, Smile was supposed to follow after Pet Sounds, and then it was abandoned. And in rock history, it was perceived to be the greatest album that we never heard. And then it comes out. He was a very tender, vulnerable, fragile kind of person. He sometimes lost his train of thought, but there were also moments where he was lucidly back in the 1960s. And it was so exciting to listen to him.
Yeah, and what a legacy he has.
An extraordinary legacy. As long as people listen to music, the Beach Boys will always be there.
Extraordinary music from Arena on Wednesday night. And we will stay with the music. Sure, why not? And it is time to take your baby raving. The little babies with their glow sticks grooving away. And that from 2FM's Graham Smith. The album is called Music for Babies to Rave and Sleep To. He talked to Shay in for Oliver.
When I was doing my research, babies, their heart rate is 50% higher than ours. So they like music to be really energetic and at a higher tempo. And that's why that song there, Toy Piano No-No, that one, it's really fast. It's like a lullaby, but it's sped up to a really high tempo. It's about 160 beats per minute. And that will get them going, gets their heart rate going, and they can do a little dance and that kind of thing. And then with the sleep, it's the opposite. So you want it rocking like a cradle, and it's supposed to mimic what they would have heard in the womb and the heartbeat and all that kind of stuff. So it's really drawn back, really slow, and hopefully you'll nod off. Don't nod off now, Shay.
It's been known to happen.
Just creep out of the room really slowly. Don't make a noise. Don't step on the second step. Shay, wake up.
That is a hypnotic feel to that.
Yeah, and that's why lullabies, because lullabies have been used for hundreds of years. Classical composers like Brahms and Schubert, they have really famous lullabies. And it's because they use certain techniques. It's that side-to-side rocking, the really slow cyclical nature of the melody. Because if your brain hears something once and then it hears it again, it's like, oh, I can relax now because I know what to expect. So it perks it up and then puts it into a state of relaxation.
Oh, very cute, and beats the hell out of Baby Shark, I suspect. And let's just spoil ourselves with a bit more music. Double dare you not to sing along to this one.
The side.
singing along in the back seat of the bus. That was, after all, from the Frankenwalters. And singer Paul Lenihan joined Ray. Because in case you're wondering, this song was born out of a row between Paul and his then-girlfriend, Katie.
I think I had an argument on the phone with Katie about something stupid. And I just came home and I was a bit upset. And I was in Ireland, you see, and she was in England. And I just decided, something prompted me to write the song. And it was kind of, I was just thinking about how much I'd miss her if she was gone, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think I was taking the relationship we had a bit for granted at the time. And I was kind of just trying to make sense of that. And I was thinking, like, you know, how people, we tend to take, you know, our lives for granted and our love for granted at times, you know. And I decided, you know, the song was just started to writing itself then. And I just think it's kind of about that for me anyway. It's about, you know, realizing what you have and kind of almost celebrating it, you know. And just it was me declaring my undying love as well, you know.
For Katie.
And I was in love at the time.
And did she know that you wrote that song at the time?
Oh, yeah, she did. Yeah.
Okay.
But life moves on and they parted ways. And of course, the song was featured in The Young Offenders and had a whole new lease of life, prompting Paul to try and find Katie all these years later.
I was so grateful for what Katie had kind of given me the inspiration. And I was just wondering, you know, where she was, because I hadn't seen her in about 25 years or something. And I was just hoping that she was okay somewhere. And I was kind of prompted then. I looked her up on Twitter and I found someone that kind of looked like her with the same name. And I just put in a request on Twitter, but she didn't come back a couple of years later because she had her Twitter turned off.
Right.
But eventually she came back and I found out she was living in England and she had been married with two daughters. And she kind of... she said that she'd come along to her next London show with her daughters, and she came along, and it was just great to meet up again, you know. And it was lovely to know that she was, you know, she was still alive, number one, and also to know that, you know, she had two beautiful daughters as well,
yeah,
you know, and,
yeah.
And you know, she had a life.
That is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. I'm not here next week. Talk to you the week after. But we're gonna have to finish with this from the late Sly Stone. Get your groove on.